Chapter 15. Was its own affair. There were at least a score of windows in its high roof alone. How many in its grotesque front, I soon gave up counting. The owner was a shopkeeper, by name Strodenheim. By trade I couldn't make out what by trade, for he had forborne to write that up, and his shop was shut. At first, as I looked at Strodenheim's, through the steadily falling rain, I set him up in business in the goose liver line. But, inspection of Strodenheim, who became visible at a window on the second floor, convinced me that there was something more precious than liver in the case. He wore a black velvet skull cap, and looked usurious and rich. A large-lipped, pear-nosed old man, with white hair, and keen eyes, though near-sighted. He was writing at a desk, was Strodenheim, and ever and again left off writing, put his pen in his mouth, and went through actions with his right hand, like a man steadying piles of cash. 5-franc pieces, Strodenheim, or golden napoleons. A jeweler, Strodenheim, a dealer in money, a diamond merchant, or what? Below Strodenheim, at a window on the first floor, sat his housekeeper, far from young, but of a comely presence, suggestive of a well-matured foot and ankle. She was cheerily dressed, had a fan in her hand, and wore large gold earrings and a large gold cross. She would have been out holiday-making as I settled it, but for the pestilent rain. Strasbourg had given up holiday-making for that once, as a bad job, because the rain was jerking in gushes out of the old roof spouts, and running in a brook down the middle of the street. The housekeeper, her arms folded on her bosom and her fan tapping her chin, was bright and smiling at her open window, but otherwise Strodenheim's house front was very dreary. The housekeeper's was the only open window in it. Strodenheim kept himself close, though it was a sultry evening when air is pleasant, and though the rain had brought into the town that vague refreshing smell of grass which rain does bring in the summertime. The dim appearance of a man at Strodenheim's shoulder inspired me with a misgiving that somebody had come to murder that flourishing merchant for the wealth with which I had handsomely endowed him. The rather, as it was an excited man, lean and long of figure, and evidently stealthy of foot. But, he conferred with Strodenheim instead of doing him a mortal injury, and then they both softly opened the other window of that room which was immediately over the housekeeper's, and tried to see her by looking down. And my opinion of Strodenheim was much lowered, when I saw that eminent citizen spit out of window, clearly with the hope of spitting on the housekeeper. The unconscious housekeeper fanned herself, tossed her head, and laughed. Though unconscious of Strodenheim, she was conscious of somebody else of me. There was nobody else. After leaning so far out of the window that I confidently expected to see their heels tilt up, Strodenheim and the lean man drew their heads in and shut the window. Presently, the house door secretly opened, and they slowly and spitefully crept forth into the pouring rain. They were coming over to me, I thought, to demand satisfaction for my looking at the housekeeper, when they plunged into a recess in the architecture under my window, and dragged out the puniest of little soldiers, begirt with the most innocent of little swords. The tall glazed headdress of this warrior, Strodenheim, instantly knocked off, and out of it fell 2 sugar sticks, and 3 or 4 large lumps of sugar. The warrior made no effort to recover his property, or to pick up his shako, but looked with an expression of attention at Strodenheim, when he kicked him 5 times, and also at the lean man, when he kicked him 5 times, and again at Strodenheim, when he tore the breast of the warrior's, little coat open, and shook all his 10 fingers in his face, as if they were 10,000. When these outrages had been committed, Strodenheim and his man went into the house again, and barred the door. A wonderful circumstance was, that the housekeeper who saw it all, and who could have taken 6 such warriors to her buxom bosom at once, only fanned herself and laughed as she had laughed before, and seemed to have no opinion about it, one way or other. B. But the chief effect of the drama was the remarkable vengeance taken by the little warrior. Left alone in the rain, he picked up his shako, put it on, all wet and dirty as it was, retired into a court, of which Strahdenheim's house formed the corner, wheeled about, and bringing his two forefingers close to the top of his nose, rubbed them over one another, crosswise, in derision, defiance, and contempt of Strahdenheim. Although Strahdenheim could not possibly be supposed to be conscious of this strange proceeding, it so inflated and comforted the little warrior's soul that twice he went away, and twice came back into the court to repeat it, as though it must goad his enemy to madness. Not only that, but he afterwards came back with two other small warriors, and they all three did it together. Not only that, as I live to tell the tale, but just as it was falling quite dark, the three came back, bringing with them a huge bearded sapper, whom they moved, by recital of the original wrong, to go through the same performance, with the same complete absence of all possible knowledge of it on the part of Strahdenheim. And then they all went away, arm in arm, singing. I went away too, in the German chariot at sunrise, and rattled on, day after day, like one in a sweet dream, with so many clear little bells on the harness of the horses, that the nursery rhyme about Banbury Cross, and the venerable lady who rode in state there, was always in my ears. And now I came to the land of wooden houses, innocent cakes, thin butter soup, and spotless little in bedrooms with a family likeness to dairies. And now the Swiss marksmen were forever rifle shooting at marks across gorges, so exceedingly near my ear, that I felt like a new Gisler in a canton of Tells, and went in highly deserved danger of my tyrannical life. The prizes at these shootings were watches, smart handkerchiefs, hats, spoons, and, above all, tea trays. And at these contests I came upon a more than usually accomplished and amiable countryman of my own, who had shot himself deaf in whole years of competition, and had won so many tea trays that he went about the country with his carriage full of them, like a glorified cheap jack. In the mountain country into which I had now traveled, a yoke of oxen were sometimes hooked on before the post horses, and I went lumbering up, 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 through mist and rain, with the roar of falling water for change of music. Of a sudden, mist and rain would clear away, and I would come down into picturesque little towns with gleaming spires and odd towers, and would stroll afoot into marketplaces in steep winding streets, where a hundred women in bodices sold eggs and honey, butter and fruit, and suckled their children as they sat by their clean baskets, and had such enormous goiters or glandular swellings in the throat that it became a science to know where the nurse ended and the child began. About this time, I deserted my German chariot for the back of a mule in color and consistency so very like a moldy old hair trunk I once had at school, that I half expected to see my initials in brass-headed nails on his backbone, and went up a thousand rugged ways, and looked down at a thousand woods of fir and pine, and would on the whole have preferred my mules keeping a little nearer to the inside, and not usually traveling with a hoof or two over the precipice, though much consoled by explanation that this was to be attributed to his great sagacity, by reason of his carrying broad loads of wood at other times, and not being clear, but that I myself belonged to that station of life, and required as much room as they. He brought me safely, in his own wise way, among the passes of the Alps, and here I enjoyed a dozen climates a day, being now like Don Quixote on the back of the wooden horse, in the region of wind, now in the region of fire, now in the region of unmelting ice and snow. Here, I passed over trembling domes of ice, beneath which the cataract was roaring, and here was received under arches of icicles, of unspeakable beauty, and here the sweet air was so bracing and so light, that at halting times I rolled in the snow, when I saw my mule do it, thinking that he must know best. At this part of the journey we would come, at midday, into half an hour's thaw. When the rough mountain inn would be found on an island of deep mud in a sea of snow, while the baiting strings of mules, and the carts full of casks and bales, which had been in an arctic condition a mile off, would steam again. By such ways and means, I would come to the cluster of chalets, where I had to turn out of the track to see the waterfall. And then, uttering a howl like a young giant, on espying a traveler, in other words, something to eat coming up the steep, the idiot lying on the woodpile who sunned himself and nursed his goiter, would rouse the woman guide within the hut, who would stream out hastily, throwing her child over one of her shoulders, and her goiter over the other, as she came along. I slept at religious houses, and bleak refuges of many kinds, on this journey, and by the stove at night heard stories of travelers who had perished within call, in reefs and drifts of snow. One night the stove within, and the cold outside, awakened childish associations long forgotten, and I dreamed I was in Russia, the identical serf out of a picture book I had, before I could read it for myself, and that I was going to be knouted by a noble personage in a fur cap, boots, and earrings, who, I think, must have come out of some melodrama. Commend me to the beautiful waters among these mountains. Though I was not of their mind. They, being inveterately bent on getting down into the level country, and I ardently desiring to linger where I was. What desperate leaps they took, what dark abysses they plunged into, what rocks they wore away, what echoes they invoked. In one part where I went, they were pressed into the service of carrying wood down, to be burnt next winter, as costly fuel, in Italy. But, their fierce savage nature was not to be easily constrained, and they fought with every limb of the wood, whirling it round and round, stripping its bark away, dashing it against pointed corners, driving it out of the course, and roaring and flying at the peasants who steered it back again from the bank with long stout poles. Alas! Concurrent streams of time and water carried me down fast, and I came, on an exquisitely clear day, to the Lausanne shore of the Lake of Geneva, where I stood looking at the bright blue water, the flushed white mountains opposite, and the boats at my feet with their furled Mediterranean sails, showing like enormous magnifications of this goose quill pen that is now in my hand. The sky became overcast without any notice. A wind very like the March East wind of England blew across me, and a voice said, "How do you like it? Will it do?" Apostrophe, I had nearly shut myself, for half a minute, in a German traveling chariot that stood for sale in the carriage department of the London Pantechnicon. I had a commission to buy it, for a friend who was going abroad. And the look and manner of the chariot, as I tried the cushions and the springs, brought all these hints of traveling remembrance before me. "It will do very well," apostrophe said I, rather sorrowfully, as I got out at the other door, and shut the carriage up. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.